This week's show on Inside the Black Box is Faster Than a Speeding Neutrino. I'm wanting to do Wally Cox's Underdog or something like that. What is it? Not plane nor bird nor even frog. It's a Sir Neutrino. And our guest is going to be physicist Eric Previs from Fermilab, who was first on our program back in, 2008. Is that right, Eric? I'm pretty sure it's 2008.
That's correct, yeah.
And that's when we were just talking about CERN coming online, right?
Right. Well, it's a little different. I mean, that was the LHC. That's the big collider, and I think mm-hmm. people are making that mistake. This result doesn't actually involve the LHC itself. It involves one of the older accelerators.
Oh, okay, great. Well, so what we're going to try to figure out today is whether or not they really had neutrinos that went faster than the speed of light, or they were drinking Jägermeister in the control room. I'm not really sure which. Either way, it should be an interesting discussion. Next up on Inside the Black Box, science only funnier.
Listen to the Overnight Alternatives on WREK Atlanta, Monday through Thursday from 1:30 a.m. to 6 a.m., and Fridays from 2 a.m. to 6 a.m. It's music to peel paint with. Embrace the other side of music with the Overnight Alternatives, only on WREK Atlanta 91.1 FM. We give all the birds a chance.
Alternative Radio is an independently produced program featuring issues and voices ignored or marginalized by the mainstream media. Ralph Nader calls it audio energy for democracy. See what he means. Tune in to Alternative Radio.
Alternative Radio airs every Sunday from 11 a.m. to noon right here on WREK Atlanta.
The opinions expressed on Inside the Black Box do not reflect those of WREK Radio or the Georgia Institute of Technology.
I live on a street near the university. Are you getting this kid? Don't know if I did.
Welcome to Inside the Black Box, a weekly program on science and technology, or as we like to think of it, science, only funnier. I'm Pete Ledovitz, and we're still wondering what's become of Bill Hunt. We don't know if he's going to be back. We don't know if his parole officer is going to let him, but hopefully that's going to change one of these days. But the title of today's program is Faster Than a Speeding Neutrino, and joining us is Eric Previs, a physicist from Fermilab, who was with us last in October 2008, talking about the Large Hadron Collider at CERN. He completed his B.S. in physics from the University of Arizona and his PhD in physics from the University of Rochester, worked at CERN, Princeton, was on the Princeton physics faculty, adjunct professor of physics at the University of Texas, and now works for the Fermi National Accelerator Lab. And do you guys still have buffalo grazing above the big ring?
Yes, we do.
And, you know, I mean, do you, like, have barbecues and something when they serve buffalo burgers? Or
you know, they actually do occasionally have a buffalo barbecue, but I think they get so attached to the buffalo that I believe what they do is trade one of our buffalo for a buffalo they're not familiar with.
So apparently the familiar buffalo is a hard thing to eat.
Well, you know, I wouldn't have a problem with it, but I don't get that attached to the buffalo.
Okay. But, I mean, they sort of roam free. I mean, does every once in a while a utility truck hit them or something like that? Or?
No, they're behind a pretty substantial fence.
Oh, okay.
And the fence is more designed to keep people out, I think, in the... I think in the old days there were some stories of people who would hop the fence and try to race the buffalo, and buffalo can actually run pretty fast, it turns out.
And actually, as I recall, the dimensions of the American bison, probably the car would look worse than the buffalo, if I think about it.
A lot of cars would come out of that exchange pretty badly.
Wow. So is there any effect on the buffalo? Any residual magnetic fields, ionization? Have they studied these guys to see if they're a little weirder than the free-range buffalo?
No, that was actually kind of an urban legend in the area when the buffalo were brought in, that they were essentially the canary in a coal mine. But in fact, if you were looking for something to tell you that there was something dangerous in the environment, you'd probably use something a little less robust than a bison.
Yeah, I would think so, because it would take a lot to put a bison.
I'm thinking the bison would outlast us if there were really a problem, but no, the bison aren't exposed to anything dangerous.
So even if there were a gamma ray release, I would think the humans would fall much quicker than the bison.
Yeah, I would guess that too, yeah. But... no, these are probably some of the best-treated bison in the world, I would guess.
All right, except when you have a barbecue, basically.
Except when we occasionally barbecue one, yes.
All right, well, let's actually begin the program, as we often do, with...
Science in the News.
All right, Dateline October 31st from the New York Times, an article by Jad Mowad. Most annoying airline delays might just be in the boarding. And they talk about a lot of different approaches to boarding. For example, Spirit Airlines has a great idea. They found that if they charged people a little bit more for the carry-on bag than they did to check the bag, that was a heck of a lot easier. And in fact, so you're a frequent flyer like I am, Eric. Do you check bags, or do you try to bring everything you own and jam it in the overhead compartment?
You know, I try to be a good citizen, which is, I try to go carry-on, but I try to do that by not bringing a lot of stuff. I'm not one of these people who tries to sneak a steamer trunk into the cabin.
Right. I mean, one of these things, it's on wheels, and somehow they never checked it in that little right-size container, and you're trying to put it
right.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of times I'll be traveling, and if I'm going to do a gig, I'm bringing a bunch of T-shirts, so I have this giant wheelie bag that I just will go ahead and check. But what's interesting enough, of all the different ideas postulated on how to optimize this boarding process, which everyone agrees probably is not so good, a few years ago, a physicist from your area, right from Fermilab, Jason H. Steffen, an astrophysicist at Fermilab in Chicago, although you're actually, are you in Batavia?
Yes.
Okay.
It's about 35 miles west of Chicago.
He figured there was a better way to board and, was held up in a jetway while waiting for a flight to Washington. I'm assuming that was O'Hare, because those can be really nasty lines. If the process was efficient, there would be no line, he said. He set out to solve the problem using a Markov chain Monte Carlo optimization algorithm. I actually have his paper from the American Journal of Physics. And this is probably our biggest problem, right? We use things like Markov chain Monte Carlo optimization, right? So optimization, we can understand. You change some variable, like the way you board, until you get the shortest boarding time. Monte Carlo is exactly what it is. You're out at Vegas or Monte Carlo or Reno. You're rolling the dice, right? You use some random number generator to sort of randomly pick how this thing would proceed based on known probabilities. And the probabilities come from some Markov process, which usually means that, the probability is dependent on N events beforehand, right? So it's a first-order Markov process, depends on the one right before that. He actually uses statistical mechanics, right? He uses a Boltzmann distribution, where he says the probability of sitting in a seat is sort of inversely proportional to the energy of that. And I, as a statistical mechanics person, I'm just pleased somebody used it for something other than conformations of, oligomers on the surface of something. But his conclusion is, if we just did it randomly, we would do much better rather than these sorts of weird things. But of course, before we started, you and I were pointing out the one constraint that we could not live without, and that is the frequent flyers like us getting in there, hogging the aisle seats and the exit rows. Yeah.
Right. I mean, this is kind of the model. In Europe, they kind of a lot of times they board planes more or less randomly. If you go through Frankfurt, they just take you all out to the tarmac and let you run for the plane.
When you're taking the bus, it works that way.
Yeah, and that's you think. I don't know, the Germans have a reputation for being organized, but certainly that was not passed on to Lufthansa, as far as I can tell. So they certainly have a lot of data on what a random boarding procedure looks like, and maybe it's fast, but it's sure annoying.
Yeah.
But he's, of course, he's come up with this structured algorithm to board.
And he could include in it, frequent flyers and boarding ahead and that sorts of things. I just don't think he bothered doing it because, to be honest, his conclusion was secondary. He actually held it up in his physics article as a useful way to illustrate how to do statistical mechanical calculations for undergraduates in physics. And it is a great problem, actually.
Yeah, in fact, I was just talking to somebody. Apparently, this was something somebody did as a science fair project, and I don't know whether they based it on his work or were doing it independently, but they said it was a very interesting thing to do.
But truth be told, these algorithms, certainly when you use them in business with enterprise servers, I mean, everything is being optimized continuously, right, when I'm working on a computer.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess what's bothered me most recently is, and Trent, I think, was surprised when I mentioned this to him, that I did not realize how they're using the cookies on my computer. Every time I do a Google search, it's different than the Google search you do. I'm erasing my cookies left and right, but when I'm erasing my cookies, that doesn't sound right. They're storing this data elsewhere. Google and other places are storing this off my computer. So I will actually log in as my daughter, because sometimes, you know, my search will either go towards statistical mechanics and you know, nonlinear optimization algorithms, or, you know, muscle ache ointment for old guys, right? I won't get the same. All right, enough of the optimization talk. So the topic today is basically what happened in CERN with the faster-than-light neutrinos. And we should probably start with, what exactly is a neutrino, the smallest and one of the lowest cross-section of some atomic particles that we typically study, right?
Right. Neutrinos are an interesting story. They were actually invented by Wolfgang Pauli to explain why it appeared that energy wasn't being conserved in nuclear decays. You had a beta decay where you see a nucleus go to a nucleus with a plus one mm-hmm. electric charge and emit a beta minus ray, which we now know as an electron. And so that should be a two-body decay, so it should have an absolutely constrained kinematic.
Oh, right.
With one going off in one direction, one going off mm-hmm. in the other direction. And that wasn't what was seen. What was seen is that the beta would be emitted with a spectrum of energies. They were considering whether this violated conservation of energy and momentum. So Pauli came up with this thing. I believe he referred to it as a desperate remedy, where he said, "Let's just imagine there's this particle that really doesn't interact and goes flying off and balances energy and momentum." And this became a cornerstone of the theory. But in fact, it was about 26 years until it was directly observed. So yeah, neutrinos are very interesting because they only interact weakly. They don't have an electric charge. They don't feel the strong force that holds nuclei together. They have a very, very small probability of interacting.
Right. So what you're saying is, when you say beta decay, that means it's spitting off a high speed electron, right?
Or positron, but most decays are when a neutron in the nucleus goes in, turns into a proton and then emits an electron, and we know now also emits a neutrino. Mm-hmm. But the probability of detecting it is such that you would never ever be able to detect a neutrino from a particular interaction. You have to make a whole lot of them and then detect some very, very tiny fraction of them.
Well, so that is the problem. I mean, the problem is because it's not charged like an electron or a positron, which would make it interact with all the charged particles in matter. This is the one that most people describe as, you know, it can happily go right through the planet with a really high probability and never interact with anything.
Right, right. The probability of a particular neutrino interacting is extremely tiny. And
right.
We've got neutrinos passing through us from the sun and from the atmosphere all the time. And so, a very, very tiny.
In fact, we actually, I think it was on April 15th, 2009, we talked to Ignacio Tabota from the School of Physics here, who's part of this astrophysics project at the South Pole, where the volume of stuff they use to interact with cosmic neutrinos is a cubic mile of ice. So it gives you an idea of how little this thing wants to interact. So is that why they chose them? Is that why they chose them? Because they could just shoot this off and capture it hundreds of miles away, and they know
They're trying to solve specific questions about the neutrino. Because they interact so rarely, they're hard to study. And and there was this what was called the neutrino problem for years, which is that when we can calculate how many neutrinos should be coming from the sun. And we can also calculate how many neutrinos should be coming from cosmic rays in the atmosphere. And it turns out that the numbers we got didn't match the predictions. And so the theory is that one type of neutrino actually oscillates into another when it's traveling. In other words, they do what's called mixing. And that's what's being studied in these experiments. And that's what this OPERA experiment was built to look at. It wasn't built to measure the speed of a neutrino. That was a side measurement they could make.
Oh, okay. So this OPERA experiment that was done in CERN was basically designed to look at this changing property of neutrinos.
Right. Specifically, it was designed to look for what's called a muon neutrino. That's, you know, the neutrinos are all the partner of of a charged lepton. So there's an electron neutrino, a muon neutrino, and a tau neutrino. And they were looking for a specific signal of the muon neutrino turning into a tau neutrino. And that's a very challenging experiment to do. That's why the experiment was built, and that's the mm-hmm. measurement they were making. It's just as a side effect, you can do these time-of-flight measurements.
Ah, okay. So we need to take a quick break, but when we come back, let's maybe talk about what they found from this OPERA experiment in CERN and why this is it safe to say, thrown the physics community into a tizzy? Can I use the word tizzy?
That's probably an accurate assessment. Okay.
All right, so we'll look into this tizzy when we come back. We'll be right back with Inside the Black Box, science only funnier.
It's not hard to find the best reggae that Atlanta has to offer. Know your roots. Keep it simple. And tune in to 5446, Thursdays from 8 to 9 p.m., only on WREK Atlanta.
As internet technology advances, so does the threat of cybercrime. In times like these, we must protect ourselves from cybercrime. Antivirus software, firewalls, and security patches are just the beginning. Never open suspicious emails and only navigate to trusted sites. Protect your child by installing parental control software and monitoring their computer use. To learn more about cybercrime, visit ncpc.org or contact your local law enforcement agency.
A message from the U.S. Department of Justice, National Crime Prevention Council, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Inside the Black Box here on WREK Atlanta, where we're talking with Eric Prebys, I guess our regular sort of theoretical physics contributor. That's what we're labeling you now, Eric, whether you like it or not. Okay, so before the break, we were talking about this OPERA experiment, which was designed to look at the transition between a tau and a muon neutrino. Do I get that
right? Other way around. The detector is actually in a place called Gran Sasso in Italy.
Mm-hmm.
Which is something like 700 kilometers away.
Okay.
So they were looking for these things that were initially muon neutrinos to turn into tau neutrinos.
And basically, they just shot these through the air?
No, through the Earth.
Oh, so they
have
a tunnel?
Neutrinos go straight, and the Earth is curved, so they go through the Earth.
Oh, okay, so, but this was not through a tunnel. It literally went through
all the matter. As we said, neutrinos just go through everything, right. So they go through the Earth with no problem.
Right. So this is like me shooting me through the Milky Way galaxy. The odds of me actually hitting something are so low that you know.
Right. Yeah. Some small fraction obviously interact with the Earth, just like some small fraction interact with the detector. But it's a very small fraction.
So was it going through two separate sites of the facility, or was it all connected?
No, it's not connected at all.
Okay, so there are two different sites, and then they send it through the curve.
The neutrinos are produced at CERN, and then there's nothing in between there and. In the detector, so that's the experimental challenge is getting the distance accurately and the relative time, the absolute time at each point accurately.
Right, and that's always been a problem, right? So when we first looked at relativity, there were lots of experiments proposed to look at this, and I seem to remember something back in the 50s or 60s of some guys on a jet with an atomic clock zipping around the planet. And they didn't even come close to look at the time dilation, you know, going...
No, they did.
Did they really?
They actually, it wouldn't be that, if you look at the data, they actually put an atomic clock on a plane and flew it around the world, mm-hmm. and they measured something, but mm-hmm. the error bars are large. And, if that were the only evidence we had of relativity, right. That wouldn't be very strong evidence.
But are the error bars large?
But, of course, relativity is vital to the GPS system. The GPS satellites have large relativistic corrections.
Ooh, okay. I mean, so when I think of the things that really sort of showed it, because, I would think the atomic clock, if the error bar is bigger than the difference in time dilation you got between the two different reference frames, you're like, okay, maybe not. But You know, you think of eclipses and the bending of light from distant sources, and if it's going over a long, long distance and you bend as it comes near a planet, you see a big difference when you're a parsec away or something like that, right?
Right, right. That's the that's part of general relativity. Uh-huh. And it actually turns out the correction, you know, for GPS satellites, for example, the general relativistic correction is larger than the special relativistic correction. In other words, the big effect is the fact that they tick more quickly, being in a weaker gravitational field. And then there's an effect on top of that they then tick a little more slowly because they're traveling relative to us. So the general relativistic correction is about 45 microseconds a day, and then the fact that they're moving subtracts 7 microseconds from that. So the GPS clocks tick about 38 microseconds a day faster than a clock would on Earth, than the same clock would on Earth. And that correction is in there. Otherwise, they would just give gibberish.
Oh, wow. So I didn't realize that was that significant. And basically, the significance is this interaction of the gravitational field and the fact that the things that are being communicated back and forth are radiation that are moving at the speed of light. So it's not like this jet that's going such a tiny fraction of the speed of light, right?
Well, it isn't really the speed. It really is the fact that in general relativity, clocks tick more slowly in a stronger gravitational field. Mm-hmm. So it's the fact that that's a pretty big difference between here and there. Now you could set the scale of the velocity by thinking about what a 1G gravity would be in terms of velocity if you accelerated at 1G for some here to in orbit, and then what the difference in velocity. That would sort of set the scale. So you can probably figure out you're talking about velocities a lot greater than airplanes when you think about that.
So it, basically, what is the difference between general and special relativity?
Well, special relativity, that's just, that was Einstein's first big revelation, and that was, you know, they had this notion, or these things called the Maxwell equations that came up with an equation for how electromagnetic radiation propagated like a wave, but they found it very confusing because waves, as they understood it, had to propagate through some medium, and there wasn't a medium, and they actually postulated a medium. They called it the ether, or luminiferous ether, and they did an experiment to try to detect it. There was a famous experiment called the Michelson-Morley experiment.
This is the interferometry
ether, the Earth is passing through it, so you know, you'll get a slightly different speed of light depending on the direction of your measurement. And they found nothing.
So
Einstein came up with this idea that let's make those our postulates. Let's postulate that the speed of light is the same in any reference frame, and that the laws of physics are the same in any reference frame. And, you know, what do you get? And what you have to give up is the notion that time is absolute in different reference frames. And, you know, that's what they did, and that's special relativity. General relativity is then when you bring gravity into it, and the postulate you add is that there's really no difference between an acceleration and a gravitational field. And special relativity is actually pretty easy to explain if you can draw pictures. It's kind of hard to explain in words. Whereas general relativity, that's a lot more complicated. That's where you get into the whole bending space-time and things like that, black holes, stuff like that. That's all general relativity.
Right. But didn't special relativity actually have a constant in it that frustrated
people?
Well,
the constant is the speed of light.
Oh, okay. So it's just the speed of light. Okay.
Yeah, the constant is the speed of light.
But I don't know which one of these is getting messed up more because of dark energy and dark matter.
Well, dark energy is dark matter. That's not really either one. Dark matter is strictly a Newtonian gravity. I mean, dark matter, you know, it's just when we look at the velocity of stars and galaxies, and we look at how fast the stars are revolving as a function of their distance out from the galaxy.
Oh, okay.
We can't explain that based on the observed amount of matter. So that's literally almost 400-year-old.
So that can be explained classically, right? That you simply have a gravitational field.
That can be explained classically by saying there's some gravitational matter. Now, dark energy, nobody knows what dark energy is. What dark energy is just that there, you know, when you solve for, you know, essentially the way the universe is expanding, you know, which involves general relativity, that there seems to be this gravitational energy in the universe over and above all types of ordinary matter, and nobody really knows what that is. It's really just a term and an equation. Nobody has a good idea, but yeah, those are general relativistic equations.
But I mean, if you think about, you know, trying to get wrap your mind about what dark energy is this, you know, an excess amount of energy that actually has the universe expanding faster than it would? Is it in the form of kinetic energy?
Well, there's actually two parts to it. There's two separate parts. One is just the energy that's there, and that has to do with how the universe is expanding, and that's the dark energy. But then there's the separate thing that it actually looks like the universe expansion is accelerating.
Oh, okay.
And that's part of that same equation, but it's a little more profound.
Okay.
But even before they knew about the acceleration, they knew about dark energy.
Ah, okay.
Yeah,
basically,
dark energy. You can have dark energy. You know, the thing is, there's this, you know, this thing about whether, you know, you could imagine the universe expanding out from a Big Bang and then collapsing again, and that's called a closed universe.
Mm-hmm.
Or you could imagine it just expanding forever, and that's an open universe. And what the universe appears to be is exactly closed in some sense, that it'll keep expanding at sort of an ever slower rate.
Oh, okay. So it's almost the neutral model of this.
Yeah,
thing.
Yeah. And there's theoretical reasons why that's favored, but that's what the dark energy does. You know, only about 5% of the mass in the universe is things we understand, stars and gases and dust.
Right.
And then about another 20% is dark matter, which we don't know what it is.
Mm-hmm.
But then about 3/4 of the universe, in terms of effective mass, is this dark energy. So it's very fascinating.
Oh, okay. So the dark matter, basically, we don't see that. We see that in the form of things moving or accelerating at a slower rate than they otherwise would, because there's something
it's faster. If you imagine an orbit, you know, the more mass you have inside an orbit, the faster something has to
go to
stay in orbit.
Right.
And if you look at the way, you know, you can look at a galaxy, and a galaxy is rotating, and you look at the velocity of the stars, if we say, okay, the matter in that galaxy follows the distribution of the stars, that gives us a very solid prediction for what the velocity of the stars should look like. And it's nothing like that. And this is very simple physics. Like I said, this is all Newtonian mechanics.
Right.
This isn't relativity. This isn't anything.
Yeah.
So this is, using very old physics, and it sticks out like a sore thumb. So, you know, we absolutely know dark matter is there. Dark energy, you know, that's based on a little more on theoretical models. It's a little harder to explain, and you have to think a little more on faith.
Mm-hmm. But if I want to illustrate the importance of energy in a system, let me actually turn to the articles by your colleague, Jason Steffen. Because he uses statistical mechanics, right, the probability of you accessing some difficult-to-find airline seat, it's proportional to the amount of energy you have, the kinetic energy, the temperature. He actually uses temperature as a variable. And he points out that he picked a temperature, because who knows what the temperature of the motion of passengers are. But if you had a lot of really irate people who were in a hurry, who were willing to knock
the temperature
small,
might be a little higher.
Yeah, a little higher. Who are willing to knock little old ladies out of the aisle, that's a higher temperature. So there you have it. Okay.
Well, and you can see that. I mean, the best example of that is driving in traffic. If the temperature stayed down, there would be no problem with cars merging and whatnot. Whereas, in fact, it's the driving standard, and you can model that as a temperature as well.
Yeah.
That causes problems.
Yeah. We also model the pressure with mechanical energy balance, right?
You can talk about cars as a simple flow algorithm, then you could also talk about, you know, how they interfere with each other when you're trying to merge.
Okay, so back to the OPERA experiment. So basically, as a side effect, they were able to measure the time of flight. So they produce these neutrons at one site.
Neutrinos.
They gather them a few hundred kilometers away. And the question is, what is the average time of flight for these things? It's got to be really short, implying you need a very precise time measurement, right?
It's 750 kilometers, and I'm afraid I can't quite do that math in my head, but that's a reasonable time of flight, and the difference they measured was about 60 nanoseconds from what they predicted from neutrinos going the speed of light.
Okay, so that was the difference. So obviously this was many, many more nanoseconds. And you're right, we
right.
Can, we can
60
that.
Represents about one part in 40,000.
Okay.
40,000. So
how do they sync the time at both sites?
Well, that, you know, that's part of the challenge. It looks like it's about 2.4 milliseconds is the time it would take. That was one of the challenges, was to get the absolute time at both points. And if you read the paper, it was a very involved procedure. I mean, they ultimately use information from the GPS system, but then that had to be absolutely calibrated. So, I mean, they went as far as to move an atomic clock from one point to the other. And, of course, even moving a clock, you bring in very small relativistic effects. So you have to account for the fact that at this level, you know, now we are talking about the effects. You know, the accuracy of these things has improved a lot since that plane measurement long ago. And for things this accurate, you really do have to take into account the fact that you're picking up a clock and moving it.
Right. So it's not simply a matter of, you know, looking to see if this measurement was statistically significant. It's not simply a statistical issue. It's, you know, is there fundamental errors in the time measurement due to this syncing problem?
Right. I mean, there's three pieces of it. One is the accuracy of the measurements of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one is the distance between the two. Now, you know, it turns out that the detector is in a tunnel, and of course you can measure positions very accurately with GPS, but then you have to use metrology or surveying techniques to transfer that measurement to a location in the tunnel. And that's where some of the uncertainty comes in. And then there's the absolute time at both points. And all three of those are the things you put together to get the time of flight or the velocity measurement.
Yeah. And it seems as though the time's got to be the most difficult one.
No, actually, well, you mean the absolute time?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, the absolute time is difficult because, you know, you've got something you've determined as an absolute reference, but of course there's delays in the signals. You have to convert that to, you know, the signal you measure. How long does it take that signal to get to your detector? And of course, you know, they go through all of these things, and they certainly, you can't read the paper and say, oh, they forgot this or they forgot that.
Right.
I mean, they really did look at everything and they cross-checked everything. It's a very, very careful measurement.
So given that, we come down to a decision. Have we disproven relativity, or are there other things that, you know, although carefully addressed in the paper, may be causing an anomaly, a discrepancy?
Right. I mean, there's a couple of possibilities. One is, you know, that there's a mistake somewhere in the paper.
Mm-hmm.
I think even the authors stop short of saying, you know, oh, we're disproving relativity. I think everybody agrees they did an extremely careful measurement. They spent a long time looking at this. But even they're saying, you know, we realize this is an earth-shattering result. So now they're kind of putting it out there and saying, you know, we're going to let everybody else look at this result too. So there could be a mistake, or there could be, you know, the mistake could be something interesting. You know, it could be something subtle about the way neutrinos interact. I sort of skimmed one paper that talked about, you know, the ways neutrinos are produced and detected. There might be a systematic problem with assigning a time to that. But, you know, it's way outside of my field, so I don't really have
Okay.
So it could be that the, quote, mistake or the problem is something interesting in its own right.
Right. So,
or some relativistic effect that of calibrating the clocks that wasn't correctly taken into account. You know, so it could actually be that whatever problem they find with the measurement is interesting itself. I mean, this is clearly a anomalous enough result that nobody would ever believe one measurement like this. I mean, this is a measurement that has to be confirmed.
But hasn't Fermilab attempted to do similar measurements?
Well, Fermilab did a effectively identical measurement. We have a very similar experiment running here.
Is that the Minos experiment?
At Minos, yeah. They did a measurement that is it's actually kind of interesting. They actually also measured a faster than light time.
Mm-hmm.
with a consistent value, but a larger error. So they measured something that was just a little more than one standard deviation. Let's see what it is. It was a little more than one error bar away from light.
Okay.
So the two results are consistent, but the Fermilab result is also consistent with the neutrinos going at the speed of light. So it's very tantalizing that they actually got somewhat similar results. Just the Fermilab had a large enough error bar that it wasn't considered significant. Now they are working to redo that measurement and should have a result next year. They're improving the timing resolution of the detectors.
So basically, you're illustrating something of fundamental importance in measurements, right? And basically, next week when I'm at the New Orleans Fringe Festival, I'm trying to explain to normal people, right, and that is people that don't know about Minos and Opera and all these sorts of things, that the error bar is really important, right? So what you're saying is you were operating at the, you know, at the edge of statistical significance, and they got a little closer to that edge with the CERN experiment. But you're floating around that. Did they actually put forward a significance level or a confidence level on this?
Yeah, they measured. They're claiming that their measurement is 60 nanoseconds with about a 7 nanosecond statistical error and a 7 nanosecond systematic error. So you normally add those in quadrature and you get something that would be like 10 nanoseconds. So they're talking about something like a 6. Standard deviation effect, and 6 is where you really start to say this isn't 6 is too large for a fluctuation. 6 is either there's a mistake or you've really measured something.
Right. Okay.
Now it's hard to explain to people. I think a lot of people don't understand why this would be such a profound result. You say, something's moving faster than light at one part in 40,000. What's the big deal? But in fact, it would be a huge deal. It's very hard to reconcile that result with theory and with other experiments.
Right, right. Experiments in theory that we've studied for the last many, many decades.
Right. I mean, the biggest, there was this famous supernova in 1987, and it was a supernova, and they actually, supernovas make a flash of light, but they also make a big blast of neutrinos. And even though the supernova was, over 100 light years away, we got a detectable wave of neutrinos at the Earth. And by comparing when the neutrinos arrived relative to when the light arrived, they were able to say that the neutrinos were traveling at the speed of light to within 2 parts per billion.
Mm-hmm.
So if in fact the neutrinos were traveling at this velocity, they would have arrived about 4 years before the light. And of course, we wouldn't have been looking for them. It would have been strange. We would have seen the light and we would have seen no neutrinos.
Right.
Reconciling this result, there's basically 3 experimental results. There's that result, there's neutrino mixing, which says that different types of neutrinos really can't be going different velocities, and there's also, there was this other thing, a little more theoretical, that if a neutrino is traveling fast in light, it should have all of these secondary effects, mm-hmm. this thing called Cherenkov radiation. And that's not seen in this experiment or in another experiment in the same hall. So, they actually had a conference at CERN last month, and they brought together, the top theorists, and they said, let's assume this result is correct. Can we come up with a theory that will accommodate it and everything else? And the answer was no.
Okay.
They were not. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It just means a conference full of very smart people couldn't come up with one.
Right. Right. So now we basically have 2 possibilities. One possibility is that this was moving faster than the speed of light, and it will require a fundamental rewriting of a lot of theory and reinterpretation of a lot of experiments. Or, and I want to make this sound like, there was a mistake, right? Like, that's easy. We just write it off as a mistake. But the truth is, given the level of correction you're mentioning that they did to account for, the time, the distance, and the accuracy, right, all being measured properly. What it means is if there's a mistake, it's a mistake that's outside our current understanding of how to sync these 3 quantities.
Well, that might be. That's a possibility. It just might also be that, it's something a little more prosaic, but just something they didn't. When you're talking about relativity at this level, comparing clocks ticking at different points, right, and moving clocks from one point to another, you have to take into account such subtle effects that and for a lot of these people, I mean, remember, you know, I'm not sure who they, you know, they probably brought in some experts. I haven't really looked at the list of authors, but most of the people in this group are particle physicists, so they certainly know about relativity and they know about making a measurement, but they're not the sort of people that, you know, there are other people who spend their lives thinking about these arcane effects in relativity. You know, these are the kind of people that that calculate, you know, what the relativistic corrections are to atomic clocks on GPS satellites, for example. You know, so, and I'm sure they brought in that expertise, but there's still always a possibility that something was missed.
Okay. All right, well, let's continue with these arcane effects after we take a break. And if you are listening to us live Wednesdays, noon to 1, and have a question or comment about this arcane but fascinating topic, give us a call here at the studio at 404-894-2468. Once again, that number, 404-894-2468. We'll be right back with Inside the Black Box, science only funnier.
Household pests are familiar subjects in childhood songs and nursery rhymes, but they can also pose serious threats to our health and property. Dealing with these threats may not be as easy as ABC, but it can be as easy as IPM. Integrated Pest Management employs common sense and sound solutions to treat and control pests. To learn more, visit whatisipm.org, a public service message from the National Pest Management Association.
Every Monday at noon, WREK broadcasts the North Avenue Lounge. It's a Renaissance interview project.
Renaissance? You mean like people in funny costumes and overgrown turkey legs?
No. I'm talking about the opportunity to get into the heads of writers, musicians, philosophers, economists, and other fascinating individuals in the greater Atlanta community.
So that's every Monday at noon on WREK Atlanta. And we're going to talk to anybody we want to talk to?
Absolutely anybody.
All right, welcome back to Inside the Black Box, where we're talking with Fermilab physicist Eric Prebys about potentially faster-than-light neutrinos. And as I mentioned before the break, if you've got a question or comment about this fascinating topic, give us a call here at the studio if you're listening live noon to 1 on Wednesdays at 404-894-2468. Once again, that number, 404-894-2468. So during the break, I mean, we were talking about maybe the three possibilities. One, that relativity has somehow changed. Two, that maybe all the measurements and corrections and timings are right. But there's an interesting interaction between neutrinos and other neutrinos and neutrinos and something
else.
Well,
not really other neutrinos, but just about the way neutrinos are formed. You know, there's many effects in classical electrodynamics. There's effects that can make it look like something is going faster than light. There's something called the phase velocity in light. Mm-hmm. And there was one argument I saw that you know, everything behaves like a wave at some level, and that there was some interpretation of neutrinos. Mm-hmm. Basically, relativity tells us information and causality can't travel faster than light.
Okay.
And you would have to show that there was to really say you'd violated special relativity, you would have to prove that there was a causal link, you know, that you could actually generate a piece of information by producing a neutrino and then detecting it at faster than the speed of light.
Okay, so this is kind of like the Bell's theorem guys who...
Yeah, it's related
to that. You can't transmit information faster than the speed of light.
Right.
Okay, all right, we've actually got a caller on the line.
Hello?
Yeah, welcome to the program. Do you have a comment or a question?
Yeah, I've got a quick question. I just want to know here's my essential issue. All of our experiments, all of our issues with physics and in the real world are sort of based on our reality as we understand it, as we know it. Our metaphors for all these experiments, when you try to explain them to normal people, seem to be based on what we can touch, what we can see, what, you know, causality, the way we understand what is and is not matter. They're all very fundamental everyday things, but is there a point where scientists just say, from an evolutionary standpoint, we're not equipped to understand certain things by the limitation of the way we grew up on Earth? The way we evolved on Earth.
Right, you're saying that philosophically, like we just cannot handle this no matter how we might make the instrumentation that way? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I'd like to know if scientists have sort of, I don't know, made their peace with, we're limited by the fact the way we evolved on Earth, and we understand that a ball rolls down a hill, because we've seen it a billion years, a ball rolls down a hill. But at some point, you know, isn't that a limitation?
Just as in, like,
well,
maybe
it
you'll
gets,
never have
it
a...
Gets to, it gets to, you know, I mean, the fundamental issue, you know, again, we say, why is it such a problem? Well, the problem is that, you know, one of the tenets of special relativity is that the laws of physics are the same in any frame of reference. And as we said, in relativity, relative times are not the same in frames of reference. And the problem you get into when you talk about faster-than-light particles is that in some frames of reference, if something's traveling faster than light, then the cause precedes, sorry, the effect precedes the cause. So if the neutrinos actually got to this detector faster than light, then in some frame of reference I can invent, the neutrinos got to the detector before they were produced. And that's the problem. And so you can
so you're
say,
almost,
well, you
you're
know,
going
mathematically,
back in time,
that's not a problem. I can say, okay, so that happened. But then you have to say, well, okay, then I'm living in a completely deterministic world that you know, we always knew we were going to send those neutrinos. And that, you know, that's where the philosophy comes in. We like to believe we're not a fundamentally deterministic world, and that the scientists made the choice to produce those neutrinos.
And I guess the question is, have scientists ever sort of grappled with that reality of, like, hey, we're limited by our reality, our Earth evolutionary biology reality? Because it just seems like clearly there's something else going on out there that we just have not experienced, you know, evolving on Earth.
Right. Well, you know, science is always going to be based around our perception and our, I mean, that's kind of a given. You know, science is always going to be based on our perception and our the things we can observe as
right.
You know, there's even science now where they talk about things, you know, like, you know, was there something before the Big Bang? That's probably not something that could ever be experimentally verified. You know, does our corner of the universe just represent one, you know, the whole 15 billion light-year bubble that we can observe? You know, there might be other universes beyond that horizon, and there's nothing we can say about them, and probably nothing we ever will be able to say about them. So those are just, you know, but we've done a pretty good job. I mean, when you look at how self-consistent the scientific understanding of these phenomena are, that just sticking in one result that sort of sticks out like a sore thumb, you know, that's never happened before. You know, this, you know, of course,
right,
this could be the first time, but I think the smart money says some explanation will be found.
Yeah, and there's always this limitation. In fact, this is the whole purpose of science. And scientists, believe it or not, you know, we think of them as these sterile individuals. I know Eric's not. He's a party guy. But, you go to these conferences and you get a few drinks at the cocktail hour or at the pub if it's in England or something like that. And they speculate about all sorts of interesting things and limitations like this. And the point is, they're just not willing to lay down. And to me, the fact that GPS, which is a standard technology now, right, I use it on my phone, the fact that that has relativistic corrections, when near the turn of the last century, when Einstein was working on relativity, this was a weird theoretical concept, and now it's part of your cell phone, effectively.
Right, and they even, you know, if you actually read the story, there was this guy, Neil Ashby, who I think he's at Colorado. He was the guy who calculated all of the relativistic corrections for the GPS system. Mm-hmm. And, you know, basically some of the engineers refused to believe it. And so the first satellite they sent up had the option of turning those corrections on and off.
Right.
But they quickly discovered that if you turn them off, then the thing just was
it's
totally
garbled,
inaccurate.
Yeah, right.
So they, you know, now they actually, they correct the GPS based on ground-based clocks pretty frequently. But remember, the GPS is a military system.
Right.
So it was very important for them to design a system that would remain accurate if the, you know, to put it mildly, the ground-based stations were vaporized.
Mm-hmm.
So it's got all of these corrections in, so the system can continue to operate. And to do that, it needs all of these relativistic corrections.
But that's a great question, and I think the answer is, yes, there may be some limitations, but no, scientists in general refuse to accept them. I'm going with that.
Right. I mean, that's science. Those limitations are part of the definition of science.
Yeah. All right. Thanks for the call. That was
a
great question. I don't remember what we were talking about before, because I'm still dealing with the.
Well, I think we were talking about some of the difficulties in the measurement.
Yes. Exactly.
And what I was saying is, you know, one of the obvious experimental difficulties is this was a fairly long pulse of neutrinos. It was about 10 microseconds long. That is the length of the pulse of protons that were used to make the neutrinos was 10 microseconds long.
And that's long.
And they're detecting a shift in that distribution of 60 nanoseconds. So that's close to a part in 100.
Right.
Or sorry, that's more than a part in 100. That's about a part in 140.
Yeah.
So they're actually right now or very soon going to redo the measurement by using short pulses of protons.
Oh, okay.
So that will take out that particular source. So, once they do that, that will basically eliminate the possibility of any direct measurement error.
Mm-hmm.
And then they will be able to focus on some of these other things like the distance or the times.
Mm-hmm. I have a question. If neutrinos generally don't interact with things and it's hard to predict that, how do they
detect them?
Yeah, how do they detect it at the end? How do they know it was going to be there?
Well, because it's a statistical thing. They basically what they do is they
blast
a bunch
of
protons.
They send a bunch of neutrinos, or
the protons make things called pions just through E=mc².
Mm-hmm.
And then when the pions decay, they make neutrinos. So the answer is, you make a huge, billions and billions of neutrinos, and then some very tiny fraction of those interact with the detector.
And I guess they're saying they all left at the same time. If you're seeing how fast they
are. Right. Well, what I mean is that for this 10 microseconds, billions and billions and billions of neutrinos left the target in a more or less uniform distribution, and then some tiny fraction of those are detected at the
okay, so it's not like they saw the neutrino at the beginning and then started timing
no,
it.
No, there's no, as we said, there's no way you could ever have a single neutrino produced and detected.
Right.
That's just, you would need, the detector you would need would be, I think, literally light years of lead to detect a particular neutrino.
Okay, so, and when you say, it was created by E=mc², we're talking about decaying into a pion, right?
Well, both. I mean, you basically, if you take this proton at a very high energy, it hits a target, and there's just a lot of energy available.
Mm-hmm.
And that energy turns into matter, and
Of
that matter are these particles called pions.
Right.
And when the pions decay, they make neutrinos, and those are the neutrinos that's how you make a neutrino beam.
Okay, so they're actually produced by literally energy to matter conversion. So it literally is
equal. Right. I mean, that's how we make all what are called secondary beams in physics.
We
hit a target with something, and then different types of particles come out.
But if I think about this, because it is relativistic effects, right, and these are very small, difficult to adjust for effects, I think back to a similar thing sort of in the chemistry field where I work, which was cold fusion. And basically the guys were getting just a little bit more neutrons coming off than they expected based on background. And actually, a lot of the physicists here at Georgia Tech repeated that experiment. In fact, they were one of the first people to repeat it. And I don't know if somebody pressured them to release that or not, but literally 2 days later, they found a temperature-dependent anomaly in the detector, right? That the slightest fluctuation in temperature would give you, a detection frequency that was different enough to actually explain the difference. And,
I mean, the cold fusion,
that was probably
an example of I have to say, one of the advantages of neutrinos, and a lot of what we do is it's important fundamental knowledge, but nobody actually cares at the, the stock market is not going to go up or down based on whether a neutrino goes faster than light.
So that's
a good thing in that it gives you the luxury of taking the time to get the measurement right. I mean, the problem with cold fusion is that there was such a profound implication, societal implication for it, that, people ran with the result way before they should have.
Right.
People were investing in palladium, and I think some good scientists maybe went bad in that process.
Yeah, and I actually think, at least I'm familiar with the work of Fleischmann and Pons. They were probably sitting there over a snifter of brandy making a calculation that say, look, if we're right and we don't announce it, we will have,
there were a lot of things going on. There was a competing group measuring the same thing, and they were in a hurry to beat each other to the punch.
Yeah, exactly. And then,
All the things that shouldn't influence whether a result comes out, but often does. I mean, scientists are human at the end of the day.
Right. And in the end, the nice thing about the scientific literature is, you put it out there, and I think people would be amazed at the number of corrections we publish on papers, right? I do a lot of modeling. the next paper is always a model that takes into account, you know, like, for example, in Jason Steffen's work, you know, do you include the frequent flyers? And you're always updating these things and always sort of correcting things. And that's
right. I think people have a fundamental misunderstanding about science. And science is really a process. I mean, you know, once you know an answer, it isn't science anymore.
Right.
So,
right.
I mean, one thing I can say is this, you know, I'm really glad this group published this result because, you know, they did a careful measurement. They put in everything they could think about, and then they publish a result. And that's really how science is supposed to work. You're not supposed to not publish a result because you're afraid it might be wrong. You know, you're
right.
Supposed to do the best measurement you can, and then publish what you get. And you look historically, particularly in the era, you know, we think of as like the grand era of experimental science, sort of the first half of this century. There were incredible numbers of wrong results published. I mean, if you go back to papers from the 50s, there's, you know, lots and lots of mistakes.
Right, right.
You know, I think we're maybe overly cautious now sometimes.
Right, and I think of it also in engineering that, you know, not only were there mistakes because they didn't understand some of the fundamental physics, it was also because they didn't understand, you know, a little extra solder on your circuit messed the measurement up as well. I mean, some of it was relatively simple stuff. I mean, I know people that have been involved in those sorts of things. But what's interesting is, and we really need to, let me at least try to summarize, is at the very, very beginning of the program, when you talked about this thing, you said, look, they did this experiment, they corrected everything they thought they needed to correct, and then they, and I think these were your words, just put it out there.
Well, I think there was a period in between there where they really, internally, they looked and said, look, is there anything else? And they really worked on this result a lot. So I think what's clear is if there is a problem, it's not something simple. It's not something you can look at.
Right.
But yeah, but they did a careful measurement. They did all the checks they could think of, and then they put it out there. And, you know, even if it does turn out that there's something wrong with it, that there's no shame in that. That's how science is supposed to work.
And the point is, at the very least, it's got people thinking about relativity and the experimental measurement and the interaction of neutrinos, which is a good thing.
Right, and it's getting, I mean, it's amazing. It's getting people interested. I heard from, you know, grade school friends on Facebook about this result when it came out. You know, I mean, I think anything that gets the general public a little interested in talking about science is a good thing.
All right, so holy smokes, that's our basic conclusion. Science has gotten people excited about particle physics again. I don't really need to say anything more about that. Other than the fact that, you know, we're not ready to can relativity yet, right? Because
something like this would take, it would take another measurement. Like, you know, let's say Minos sees the same thing.
Right.
You would still look for common, you know, possible kind. You would have to think of a very different. The problem with the Minos and this measurement is they are at heart kind of similar techniques.
Mm-hmm.
I think if the two experiments saw the same thing, that would be enough evidence to design an experiment specifically to test this.
Okay.
In other words, not tack it on to a running experiment, but say that, you know, this is an important enough result that we have to think of an experiment designed just to measure this and do it. You know, that's where I think that would go from there.
As opposed to the original purpose of that experiment was to look at this transition between types of neutrinos.
Right. And I think, okay. Maybe not a whole new experiment, but at least a dedicated, and that's actually kind of what they're doing at this experiment now. They're running the beam in a special mode that's designed to test this effect, and unfortunately, that will eliminate one very important possible source of error, but all of these other things, like, you know, do you have the distance right? Did you get the relative time right? Those still remain questions. But at least it solves one very important experimental uncertainty. Once you do that, then that statistical error will fall to very close to zero, because you won't have this sort of complex fit anymore.
Right. And I guess the most interesting thing that I learned was that there are actually relativistic corrections in GPS satellites.
Yeah, and in fact, what's interesting is, you know, special relativity comes in all the time. I mean, any particle accelerator uses special relativity, but to my knowledge, the GPS, and I could be wrong, but as far as I know, it's the only practical application of general relativity.
Okay. So at the very least, we've got a whole group of folks fascinated by the experiment. Will you get more physicists out of this? I mean, we got a heck of a lot more chemists when they put CSI on the air. Everybody's interested in that.
You know, maybe so. I think we still get physics students.
Okay. Okay. All right. Well, that's good to hear. So you're headed to CERN next week, but it has nothing to do with this, right?
No, nothing to do with this. My work is on the LHC.
Okay, the Large Hadron Collider.
Large Hadron
right.
Collider.
Much
yeah,
bigger, heavier particles.
What's called the super proton synchrotron, the SPS, and that's actually one of the accelerator chains. So the SPS accelerates particles to inject into the LHC, but of course it only does that about once a day.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest of the time it's producing, among other things, particles for these neutrino experiments.
Yeah. And just out of curiosity, what do Minos and OPERA stand for? We've had a whole slew of acronyms here. Or is this one of these IT
Minos meant, you know, that's a good question. Minos means main injector neutrino oscillation search.
Mm-hmm.
And it just means the main injector is one of the accelerators at Fermilab, and they're looking for neutrino acceleration. I'll be quite honest, I don't know what OPERA stands for.
Okay, and that's okay. Yeah. That's a perfectly valid thing in here. And apparently you're not familiar with the process by which the American bison out there at Fermilab actually become part of the barbecue. But, Eric, thank
no,
you
I don't
so
know much. Let's see. So the OPERA experiment, I was just Googling it quick. Oscillation project with emulsion tracking apparatus.
Okay, which means
it actually
operates.
They use a very old technique. It's actually a technique similar to the old days with bubble chambers, where they
look
for tracks.
The cloud chamber type things, yeah.
Not in bubble, but they use emulsions.
Okay. So it's not like a mist coming off. It's literally an emulsion.
It's literally emulsion. They actually the problem is to see these tau neutrino. The distance between when it's produced and where it decays is very, very short. So they actually have these emulsions where the particles interact with the emulsion. They expose these bricks for a period of time, and then they take them out, and they actually literally have to slice them up and use very old techniques for kind of scanning.
Oh, wow.
They may even use people. I'm not sure they use people.
Okay. All right. So are you saying they're shooting the neutrinos at people and then carving them?
No. They use people to actually look at these things.
Oh, okay. To actually examine
the results.
In
the old days, the way bubble chambers worked is they took pictures of them, and then they actually had people look at the pictures.
I remember seeing those, You can still see those on the Internet. All right. Well, many thanks to Eric, now our regular Fermilab contributor here on Inside the Black Box, for trying to shed some light on this. And I think basically what we've learned is this is a new exciting time in particle physics.
Yep.
So thank you so much for being on the program. And if any of our listeners have a question or comment about this program or a suggestion for a future show, by all means, send us an email at comments@insidetheblackbox.org. Trent Altman is our chief engineer. Our theme music is composed and performed by Bill and Mary Hunt, and we are a production of the WREK Studios here on the campus of the Georgia Institute of Technology. Please join us next week for Inside the Black Box, science only funnier.